Hello, everybody. Welcome to this session. As you probably know, some of you may know, hopefully many of you will know, we do these just about every Friday. I've done since I think probably March, haven't we? We've done tons of these sessions. And really, it's just a chance to have a yak about data protection and all those kind of things. And I'm joined by two of my consulting colleagues, Dave Holmes and Ollie Rea. And you know, this isn't our session, it's your session. So if you want to join in and put comments in the chat and, you know, share your experiences or ask questions, then, you know, please feel free to do that. We tend to generally have a bit of a yak about what's been in the news, and then this time we're talking about New Year's resolutions, and then we'll kind of highlight what we're going to be covering. We've published a program of what we're going to be trying to cover each time going forward for the next 6 weeks. And of course, this month we've got International Data Protection Day on the 28th, so it's a great opportunity to do something internally to raise awareness of data protection. So we're going to do a six-hour marathon podcast on that day, so we've got to schedule all that, but that'll be quite good fun. Looking forward to that. Dave, Ollie, do you want to say hello?
Yeah, no, hi everybody. I hope you all had a good Christmas and New Year. So it's hope you're all well. It's I'm based down in a grey looking Essex at the moment. We had a bit of snow this morning, but other than that, we're all well.
Yeah, afternoon all. Likewise, as Phil was saying before, lots of heavy snow where I am, Leeds. And yeah, Phil, we're recording this today, aren't we?
I'm just trying to find, it's in the SharePoint, and I'm trying to find the privacy notice for recording. So our intention is to record it.
You have already started recording it, by the way.
I don't know who started recording it. Hold your hands up. Who started recording? I'll have a look. Have you got the privacy notice, Miles? Or do you want me to find it? Miles, you there?
Oh, yeah, I'll try to find it at the same time, Phil, see who gets it first. I think I've got it somewhere.
All right, fine. Well, let's just start on. Ollie, Dave, you know, there's quite a lot of. When we spoke yesterday, we thought there wasn't very much that has happened in the news. But actually, I was talking to Ollie just before you joined, Dave. I flicked through my reading folder, and there's actually tons of stuff that's been going on. The least of which is probably, or not the least of which, is probably this Brexit thing, which eventually resolved itself. Anything that you've noted in the news quickly?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. Brexit is partly resolved, isn't it? I mean, Brexit's happened. We're now no longer a member state. We're no longer in Europe. We've got the UK GDPR. We've got this 6 month or between 4 and 6 months period in order for them to determine adequacy. And what that may be, we may get onto talking about that later. But there are a couple of other bits. I was quite interested. I've certainly shared it on LinkedIn for those that have followed the stuff that we put out and I put out on LinkedIn. I was interested to see that there's something about British Airways going to start entering into negotiations to settle compensation claims from Q1 of 2021. And that's calculated, or somebody's calculated whether it's correct or not, but it certainly gives us something to talk about. Going to be in a region of about £3 billion. And I thought that was quite interesting. I thought it was quite interesting. Not necessarily just because of the value there, but just the fact that compensation can outstrip any costs or any fines that may be awarded by the regulator. So the £20 million that they've paid is certainly dwarfed by the potential bill for compensation at £3 billion. In addition to anything else that they're spending on, such as a resource diversion and cost of cleanup for correcting all of this, it's still ongoing for British Airways, and that must now be amounting to some. So it's a staggering sum. Whether it totally amounts or not, it's certainly a staggering sum, but it's certainly an eye opener as well to how these things can snowball in addition to anything that the ICO can possibly consider.
Sorry, Dave, I was just going to say, to clear up on that figure, because I drilled down into that figure because I was quite interested. They reckon that that's based off of £6,000 worth of compensation per victim. So that's what they reckon.
Six grand.
Individually.
Right.
Wow. So that's not factoring in legal expenses and.
No.
Wow.
No, that's purely in damages, but that is coming from the claimant side, so we'll have to see how that develops.
Yeah, likewise. The other one similar to that, and although it's not talking compensation at the moment, it's another one that was out recently, and I know, Phil, you might want to talk a little bit about SolarWinds. But again, I was interested to see, interested to read an article suggesting that shareholders of SolarWinds are going to be suing SolarWinds for the loss in share price.
Because that's a turn, isn't it?
Because of the security issues that should have been aware of. Wow. Now, that's quite an eye-opener, because that then makes the whole issues of things going wrong quite scary, doesn't it, when your own shareholders turn on you.
Yeah, I wasn't going to say much about this, apart from the ICO made a statement about it. I don't know, people might not know SolarWinds, but they provide a whole load of tool sets to monitor network traffic and manage network traffic. We use them, actually, when we're going on site to do security assessments. We use some of the labs, the mobile software labs, just for testing of network settings, firewall settings and things like that. But to have that platform compromised, is a global problem. And the ICO, took to announcing, that this is a massive, massive problem potentially, and people needed to be aware of it. So, a relatively unknown company, but someone's gone kind of strategically, if we get into these people and get into kind of billions of records in other people's networks. In fact, one of the things that I was interested in, Dave and Ollie, was on IT Gov's website, they've got a list of data breaches and cyber attacks, and there's 148 million records were breached in December alone, and they reckon that 20 billion records breached over the course of 2020. I mean, it's a lot of activity still, isn't it?
It is. It might be worth going back to IT governance just to ask them if they can drill down further into that information and find out how many records were disclosed or accessed through having poor quality passwords. Because coming back to the SolarWinds, the access to the server there was with a password that was SolarWinds123, with the irony of it all. Very similar to Equifax, I think it was. Was it the Argentine Equifax that had the breach a few years ago, and that the password there was the default password of admin? And you're kind of thinking, these things...
It's just unbelievable, isn't it?
Just keep coming back and back and back with basic security measures of just make what passwords have you got in place? Is it really going to be something? Yeah.
I was helping Dilik actually put some slides together for training she's done this morning on the security, and we were looking at the Poneman Institute's report, and basically they see like 52% of all cyber attacks are caused by, these numbers might not be accurate, but basically it's 52% are caused by human error, and of those 52% caused by not by human error, let's say. I think it was actually 48% by human error, and not by human error, by malicious attack and so on and so forth. But kind of 99% of those not by immediately identifiable human error are caused by human error, weak passwords and things like that. So it's still a real recurring problem.
Scary, especially the size and scale of organisations such as SolarWinds. Had government organisations working for them, you'd have thought they'd have had relative security in place, and not just softwares and systems, but an actual understanding of, well, what passwords are we using? If someone's going to hack the system, do you think they'll guess the password?
It's probably stuck on a post-it note, so they probably know exactly what the password is using. I tell you, did you see that thing I wrote a blog about it yesterday? Actually, the Belgium Data Protection Authority was looking at the use of professional emails once people have left the business, and they basically have said that you shouldn't be keeping any kind of mailboxes any longer than 3 months after somebody's exited the business. Interesting. I mean, there's a lot of devil in the detail, and it was in French, we had to translate it, but it was quite interesting the way that the approaches are taken. I think quite a lot of holes in it, but it's kind of one of those lines in the ground, isn't it, which is there to have a look at and to try and push the boundaries on. But to have a data protection authority make that kind of ruling and set out a process for how it should be decommissioning. And they actually said that if people are allowed to come and collect their personal possessions effects from their offices, then they should be allowed to go through all their emails and collect their personal emails from the email trail. And you imagine how much time that would take.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I actually think the plan that they published for switching off an email and that kind of thing that you just referred to, I actually agree with it. I think most information should be set somewhere other than within your emails. We shouldn't be, and we're all guilty of it. I'm guilty of it, where your email base becomes your little database of its own, doesn't it? But it's got to be switched off at some point. Whether the 3 months is a bit tight, or whether the 3 months arguably could be extended, but the concept of at some point you're going to have to turn it off. And at some point, you're going to have to address the information that's in there and that kind of thing. I think the fundamentals are there. I think it's just, like you say, working through the practicalities, what it actually means for your organization and how that will be managed.
Yeah. Did you see the Amazon doorbell got hacked as well? I mean, that was a really weird story. So the people are what's it called? Is it swatting? So if you know somebody's got an Amazon doorbell, you basically ring up the police and say, you know, I'm being held at gunpoint at this property. And then they come down, the SWAT teams come down and raid the property. And as they're raiding the property, the video stream from the Ring doorbell is live streamed. And then what happened was the people sort of hacking into these systems were shouting abuse at law enforcement officers as they were raiding the premises. I mean, this is Internet of Things again, isn't it? You know, Internet of Things poorly protected. But I mean, Amazon are really good at everything, aren't they? But I'm surprised they got that vulnerability in their Ring doorbell system.
It makes you wonder, doesn't it? Because I think it comes back to one of the points I like trying to raise with people when I'm delivering training is it does come down to that configuration. If you've got some software, is it configured properly? And I know this is a slight side part to the point that you're trying to raise, but how many people have actually got systems that are poorly configured? So how many people, say, for example, and I'm only raising it because there's a client that I'm aware of, has got the Office 365 platform, but hasn't configured data loss prevention policies within that in order to limit data disclosure or a non-data disclosure or data disclosure that's happening that maybe needs to have more control measures around it. Mm. So it comes back to the very point that you're saying, we've got these things, but does anybody actually really configure that, understand the configurations on it, or do they all just accept the default settings and think that's enough to protect them?
Don't know. Well, have you read through the new ICO data sharing code of practice yet?
Loosely, I found it quite interesting in the fact that it only actually covers controller to controller sharing. Right. Doesn't cover controller to processor. Makes right. that quite clear.
Right. Well, I don't know if anybody else has seen, but this is due for adoption later on in February, I think. So it's currently out for consultation. It's available on their website. It looks pretty good actually. 88 pages, isn't it? It's usually quite good, their data sharing.
I think 88 pages is a standard publication.
Yeah, at least it's one you can download this time. A lot of them seem to be just ones that are available online. Ollie, have you got any? Remarkably quiet, Ollie. Have you got anything you want to throw into the mix here? Do you want to comment on the way that, I mean, we don't want to dwell on this international transfers because we know how it's turned out, you know, and it looks to me, I think, we'll get an adequacy arrangement. So I think that the urgency and the pressure relating to that before Christmas has probably gone away. But I still think all the European essential guarantees and new standard contractual clauses will take effect, and we'll have to comply with those. But what have you got, Ollie, in your items for discussion?
Yeah, I've got a few bits and pieces. Just to circle back to the Amazon point before that we're making, I did notice this morning when I nipped onto Amazon for something that their cookie banner is much improved following fines handed down by the CNIL recently. Right. I did sort of notice that. Couple of bits and pieces that I found. Quite interestingly, sticking with the CNIL, and sort of on the flip side of, we were talking about before, some really large organizations and some very large fines. On the flip side of that, the CNIL this month have fined two individual GPs €3,000 and €6,000 respectively for failings relating to security and breach reporting. Now, it's interesting because these aren't GP surgeries. So in France, you can have individual GPs who set up on their own. They're sort of the village doctor, and it's just them in a sort of a two-room scenario. So these are individuals being fined by the CNIL thousands of euros.
For what? That was,
so for breaches of security. So essentially what had happened is that they had some of their systems configured in a way that the sort of main point that they've been picked up on is that they were taking pictures, whether those are x-rays or otherwise, of their patients' conditions and storing them, but storing them in a way that they were publicly accessible on the internet.
Right.
And then when they discovered that, they failed to report it. So that's just compounded the issue.
Yeah. So just a related topic. Did you see that there's a plastic surgery private healthcare providers being held to ransom? The hackers are saying, we've got hold of all these pictures, plastic surgery pictures, and we're going to release them unless you pay us. That was in the news as well over Christmas. Anyway, sorry, interrupted.
No,
how did you find out about that one, Phil?
Say again.
How did you find out about that one? Did you get the email?
yeah, got tipped off by my nose job, man. No, it was just in Lexology, one of those things that you're kind of browsing over a cup of coffee in the morning. Very funny, Mark. Appreciate it. Carry on, Ollie.
No, I think Mark's got quite a good point there.
I hope I want in that list.
No comment.
No comment indeed. A few other bits and pieces. I've seen that this morning, I think it's this morning, the State Commissioner for Data Protection for Lower Saxony, so that's on a federal level in Germany, has handed down a fine of €10 million.
€10 million
at a federal level.
Wow.
To a company for unauthorized and unjustifiable use of surveillance cameras in the workplace.
Right.
Basically, wow. They said that it was for monitoring shipping and stock coming through the warehouses and then for preventing crime. But the state commissioner said that's not proportionate. You didn't explore any sort of milder measures prior to jumping straight to surveillance cameras. So yeah, €10 million. I assume it will be appealed, but this is just in the first instance. But that's quite a lot for a, you know, a lower federal level.
It is, but it's in Germany, isn't it? So there's slightly different rules, aren't there? I mean, there's mandatory DPOs and there's workers' councils, as there are in France. So I think, you know, they must have flagrantly ignored lots of different checkpoints, which I'm not sure we've got all of them in the UK, but it's still interesting at that level, as you're quite rightly saying.
No, you would have to think so, yeah. Excuse me. And finally, the last bit I've seen is Google's new approach to cookies and their new strategy that they're going to be rolling out. So I've noticed that Google essentially have a plan to replace all web browser cookies for advertising purposes with a less intrusive system. So they're looking to de-identify a lot of that and rely on personal data much less for advertising purposes. Now, this is all still currently being trialed. It's in their sandbox project. In fact, you can go and have a look and actually be part of the consultation process on that, I think, currently. But the Competition and Markets Authority in the UK have gotten involved, saying that, in theory, it could disproportionately affect marketing agencies and the advertising sectors across the UK. And they're quite concerned about this, so they're going to be working with the ICO on it. But all very interesting, I thought.
It'll be interesting to see how that maps out, won't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I forgot to mention, actually, that Belgian email thing. They a small company of 13 people, and they fined them €15,000 for over-retention of email in data. But, I mean, imagine some of the subject access requests that we've handled last year, yeah, and the colossal volumes of emails and attachments, you know, hundreds of thousands of pages of information. So, you know, going back, do you remember that firm we worked with, 30 years worth of email data, traffic and documentation? I mean, it's an endemic, isn't it, over retention particularly email data. As Dave says, it's quite hard to erase from, well, it's easy to erase from your systems, but everyone seems to be very nervous about it.
I think, especially with emails, I think you get into the trap between, you could go down the line of arguing, well, if you need to return it, you need to keep somewhere appropriate to return it. Now, for those of our clients that work within the housing sector, you say some of that could be against the housing management file, but you may well have emails between yourself and a colleague, or between yourself and your team, or members of your team, that you don't actually at that moment in time have a relevant store for. But people want a return hold of the email to prove conversations have been had or direction was given. So it's not necessarily always easy to try and encourage people to say you don't need that anymore, when people naturally just want to hold on to things to as a get out of jail card.
Yeah. And we know from the SAR Bureau work that, you know, some of the important information, let's say, is contained within a trail, padded out with unimportant information, but the whole lot, you know, is retained because of the way that emails are structured. It makes it quite difficult, doesn't it? The final point, I don't know if you noticed it, I don't know if Umar's on the call, but I noticed that Amazon are getting into pharmaceuticals, and this is causing some concerns in the kind of online pharmaceutical retail business in the UK. And what Amazon are saying they're going to do, or what this report and the BBC was saying they're going to do, is they're going to start to be much more proactive in sort of preventative healthcare and using all the masses of data they've got to predict people's medical conditions and then kind of help them with online diagnoses and then ultimately ship them prescribed medicines, you know, quicker than they can get in other from other sources. So yeah, interesting, might shake up the pharmaceutical sector, but it just interesting use of data, and half of you thinks, well, yeah, it's, it, you know, it, is it right that the healthcare sector becomes more proactive, less reactive, or is it an invasion of people's privacy to use their data for those purposes? Torn really between which way to think about it.
No, for sure. Yeah, no, for sure. Sorry to jump in there, Ollie, but for sure. But in relation to that medical information, I don't know if you also picked up on it, Phil, without just kind of spending the hour talking about what's in the news. The COVID privacy data in Singapore is made available to police. And I'm sure I've read somewhere that Italy, although
it was Italy. It was Italy. I read it.
Yeah,
as well.
And I think Ollie confirmed this morning the French are also doing it, where they're retaining a list of people who are not having the vaccine.
Yeah, I think that was more for saying, you know, people have a claim against the government. So, well, look, we offered you this and you refused it, I think. But anyway, let's move on then, shall we? So what we want to talk about today was this January. And it's the first week back after Christmas. Everyone's absolutely chipper about it. So, you know, it's a period of reflection usually over Christmas and New Year. Lots of long walks, as there was nothing else to do. So, you know, what would we be doing? You know, what are our New Year's resolutions in kind of professional data protection space? So we thought we'd have a chat about that today, didn't we? And so if there's one thing you were going to do, Dave and Ollie, you know, what would it be? If there's one thing, is all right, this year is my year for what is that one thing that you're gonna, you know, potentially focus on or suggest people focus on? Dave,
I was gonna say, do you want to go first, Ollie?
Yeah, that's fine by me, especially because I interpreted the topic ever so slightly differently.
Oh, did you? Well, how did you interpret the topic?
Ever so slightly, in that we're talking about New Year's resolutions, and for me it was sort of the case of, right, well, what's the first thing we're going to look at in the new year? Let's get things started off. And less so possibly the focus for the year, but just sort of where do we start things and where, how do we kick things off on the right foot? And get things underway. And for me, at least on my end and with some of my clients, the big thing that we're going to be focusing on early doors is going to be data mapping, and sort of working on doing a big data mapping exercise, making sure that those ROPAs, which we have to keep, are not only completed but are being kept up to date, are comprehensive, and that they're being utilized to the maximum of their potential, really. And then there are a few things that sort of come out of that, and I'll maybe keep those for a bit later, but that's the first thing I really want to get stuck into for the start of the year.
What about you, Dave?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. I would agree with Ollie, because as we discussed, the law's changing. The law has changed. We've got the UK GDPR. You may also be caught by the EU GDPR, and depending on what your operations are like and where which countries you're operating in. So you've got a general review to make sure things are in place anyway. But that, to be fair, that kind of links in with what Ollie was saying around data mapping, making sure your ROPAs are up to date. Then naturally everything should follow on from, if your ROPAs are up to date, is your privacy policy up to date? Are your other policies amended to highlight the differences or to be transparent about how things have changed? But for me, in addition to that, you're kind of thinking, is everybody, if you had a few minutes to sit down and think about it, is everybody in a position where they actually know where their risks are? So if you could turn up to the boardroom and say to somebody in the boardroom, for example, can you provide me the what are the top five risks, that information risks or data protection risks that this organization is facing? Would anybody be able to actually reel off what the top five are?
It's an interesting one, because I think this year I'd be wanting to suggest far more compliance checking, auditing, assessments, you know, things of that nature. But one of the big things on list was also exactly that, Dave. You know, do I know where my risks are? Are my risks in my supply chain? Are my risks in the over retention of data? You know, where are my burning problems? So, you know, maybe a risk assessment, you know, and an evaluation of risk is actually the most sensible place to start. But again, I don't know if anybody else has got anything they want to chuck in, but interesting. So how would you kind of, Ollie, you're taking a slightly different approach here. You're saying, well, you know, I'd start here and then I'd progress through. So how would you see that kind of action plan rolling out over the course of the next 12 months? Have you kind of gone that far?
Well, I've got a brief idea, and actually we were speaking the other day, weren't we, about that project plan I'd put together for one of my clients, and sort of
was excellent. It was a first class bit of work. Well done, Mike.
Yeah, cheers. But yeah, sort of moving into the new year, and almost to a degree, we know what we have in place, and we have a good idea of what we have in place and where we're good and where we're bad, where we're close to compliant or maybe we're falling short. However, to start the year off, I'm looking to almost start from scratch to a degree. And as I say, carry out a large data mapping exercise, use that and flow into that, look at our ropers, how good they are, I said before. But then subsequently, there are other things that I'm going to look to sort of draw out of that. So obviously, one of the big ones is going to be data sharing, whether that's domestically, and transfer arrangements we have in place, whether those are adequate. Maybe a big review of those, big supplier review that come out of that as a natural action. And then obviously the big one, which we've, you know, slightly touched on, which is going to be international transfers, how those are all affected, whether those are all up to scratch or not, what we need to do. And then the final point, and this ties in slightly less with the natural flow of things, but it does still tie in to a degree with looking at where we are by taking a good long hard look at our ropers, but is security arrangements. Because I think it's something that's really been brought home to me, especially we were talking before about this SolarWinds business where, you know, passwords like SolarWinds 123 are still being used. Well, actually, you know, how do we compare against security standards? Where are we on that? You know, we have password management policies, but are we actually applying them as much as we should? So for me, those are some of the big areas that I'm going to be looking to subsequently.
Do you think that sometimes to privacy professionals, the IT security is a bit of a black box, a bit of a unknown black art that we can't quite get under the skin of because it's very complicated?
It's funny you should mention that, because just this morning, Dave and I were on a call with one of our clients who have had an incident recently, which we're still sort of looking to quantify whether it actually constitutes a data breach or not. But it's really quite highly technical. And from an information security perspective, even though we have sort of a bit of a grounding in that area, as you say, it is a bit of a dark art. We're not fully as clued up as we would like to be. So, I mean, personally, we've had to rope in some of our security partners onto the project to sort of give us a bit of a steer. But you're absolutely right. I think there is still a degree, and I can only speak for myself, but where privacy professionals are perhaps slightly more in the dark than we should be on the security side of things. Mm. I certainly am anyway.
So that's one to get. What do you think, Dave?
I absolutely agree with everything Ollie said. I think when it comes to security, there's parts we can do. I think it's knowing where your weaknesses are and knowing the fact that actually a lot of this is a collaborative effort, and you need to realise the people are the partners that you can work with to address issues. When you're looking at security measures, for example, we could ask questions around whether you've got data loss prevention in place, whether you've considered appropriate training and security. But when you're looking at the really technical elements of transport layer encryption, or you've got endpoint-to-endpoint encryption, or you've got scripting issues on websites, that's publishing personal data within URLs or being subject to SQL injection and things, you need people who actually understand all that kind of stuff. And although I can talk my way around it, and I understand it to a degree, when you start getting to those parts, I do start pulling in the partners and the people we work with, the companies that are part of the group that we belong to, or individuals with that knowledge to kind of go, look, you need to play your part within this DPIA, because we're now talking about something where we need your technical expertise. And I don't necessarily see that's a bad thing, but I certainly think we need to be working collaboratively where you get the really technical elements on the same score. That I wouldn't expect ethical hackers to understand and be able to critique ropers, for example.
Yeah. Ollie, I'm going to ask you to, you might not want me to do this, but I'm going to ask you anyway. So you talk about data mapping, but what tools are you kind of using for that? How deep are you going on it? And how are you going to record that? Because it's a complex area, isn't it? And, you know, are you trying to trace all the data flows, or attach yourself to a piece of data and see where it goes? Because it's going to get split up, isn't it? It's going to go to different systems. It's going to get processed in different ways by different teams, for instance, and disclosed and to different organizations, and then it might come back round again. But how far are you intending to take that mapping exercise?
Yeah, I really wish you hadn't asked me that, because
I've just dropped off the call.
No, but you're absolutely right. From my perspective, I'm looking to do this with a couple of clients, and one of whom who we've worked with for already a certain amount of time. And there are things in place there, and there are sort of ropers that are more or less complete. There are previous data mapping exercises that have been carried out, and we have generally a reasonably good idea of what's what. But for me, it's going to be in two parts. One is going to be really sort of testing that. So, you know, previous exercises that we've carried out, well, were they sufficiently comprehensive, and did we actually catch everything that we wanted to? And then secondly, sort of possibly sort of retreading over ground that we've already visited and sort of going, well, actually, you know, was this sufficiently comprehensive at the time? So to me, I'm looking to go into really quite a lot of detail with it, because I think we're at a stage now where we need to be digging deeper into this, because if we haven't, then it's sort of not really justifiable. I think if you were just starting out on a compliance journey and you sort of did a sort of low level mapping exercise to get you started, that might be one thing. But I think if you're at a certain point in the journey, you really have to be pushing that to make sure that you've really covered off all your bases, because there's sort of no excuse at this point, I would argue.
We've always said it's an incremental piece, isn't it? So start off, you know, broad brush, and then incrementally dig into it in more detail, probably in focusing on areas that are the greatest risk, you know, the most sensitive data, or the most volume of data, or those that get disclosed to the most, or whatever. But Dave, sorry, you were going to say?
Yeah, and I was just actually going to come back to the methods in which you record that, because it comes back to one of the points when I was talking about security, and looking at security is not necessarily just being technical issues in that sense. But if you've got your mapping and you've gone through all of that exercise, and we all know when we've done it, it's a huge piece of work that can take quite a few months on, depending on the complexity of your maps. If you retain that, for example, in Excel, and the Excel document's not sufficiently or adequately protected itself, or it becomes corrupt, then you've suddenly lost all that intelligence, you've suddenly lost all that knowledge.
But it could be that could be really quite dangerous as well, because within that spreadsheet you might have all sorts of technical information around how that data is transported or protected. So this is the kind of stuff when we're doing a PCI audit, they would call it work paper, you know, and you have to keep it for 3 years. But we have to make sure it's absolutely locked down, that nobody other than the QSA can access it. You know, in our business, it's all in a very secure folder that you lot can't even see.
And that's what I mean when it's, if you said, what was your biggest risk? Well, one of your biggest risks might be the fact that your official documentation, if you want to classify that under the GDPR, so your ROPAs, all that mapping, all that great intelligence that Ollie and you've just discussed, if that's all in a format that could be corrupted and lost quite easily, well, surely that's quite a high risk as a security issue, because you've lost that intelligence. Not security as in it's compromised, not security as in a data breach, but just a security issue, and you've lost the security of having in play.
Yeah, that's a good point. Now, Miles in the background has been doing a bit of a questionnaire, I think. I don't know if I'm doing the right thing here. It's on my screen here with some number of votes. If I click on done, I don't know if it's going to disappear off my screen or move to a different screen, but it seems like the majority of people who've responded, 39 people, have said that audit and compliance checking is really where they want to be prioritizing, so increasing their activity in that area. 45%, and accountability and documentation, so kind of picking up on your point, Dave, is the second most responded to question at 40%, and then kind of least is reinvigorating the remediation program. Hopefully that would suggest that the remediation programs are long and gone and history, and actually we don't need to reinvigorate it, because we are now in a compliance situation and it's really business as usual, you know, an audit, compliance checking and reviewing documentation and things like that, where we're focusing rather than remediating action plans. And again, low scoring is documenting and refreshing consent. So you can hopefully, that's an indication that either people are not using consent as lawful basis, or that they've got, you know, reliable records now. I'm going to click on done, because I don't know what that's going to do. It's going to move it away, so I have lost it. So it's good to have a comment, talk to me then. Dave, you were talking about something slightly different about the ropers. Have you said everything you wanted to on that, or is there anything else you want to pick out about why that would be kind of top of your list of things to focus on? I mean, it's a linchpin to me. It's the first thing we ask for when we're doing any formal audit. Show us your ROPAs. It gives me a good feel for, you know, what you're doing, what type of information, how you're disclosing it, retention's recorded on there. It's an absolute fundamental linchpin, isn't it, of any information governance management system.
Yeah, no, for sure. Your ROPAs are really quite key. They're kind of like your Bible, and everything, in my eyes at least, kind of links to that or comes from that. So it's got your lawful basis for processing. It documents what you're doing and why you're doing it, how you're doing it, who's got access to it, how long you're keeping it for, and all that kind of really key intelligence. But once you've got it, the obligation is to maintain it. There's no point. It's not like, have you got a policy in place? Yes, here's the policy, but you never review policies. It's the whole governance of the document. And because the processing activities change over time and things, it's making sure that your ROPAs reflect that. So it really is a key document to maintain in that sense. And I would always make sure that we've got some kind of review process in place. So if you've not reviewed your ROPAs since designing them and building them in the early days, or even prior to the GDPR, in preparation for the GDPR, they certainly could do with a review at this point. In that sense, and that's kind of where the focus with the ROPAs was coming from, in addition to making sure that you've not put all that time and effort into developing something that could easily be corrupted and lost.
Yeah, actually, I've just seen there's another question that I didn't fill in. It must have appeared then disappeared, but anyway, information security was the kind of the most pressing, along with data retention as the second most pressing in that first part of the survey. I just kind of flicking through the chat, I don't know, again, if people want to put anything on there, but I've seen a note from Becky. I will send out I won't do it now because I will have to, you know, I can't do two things at once. I'm either talking or I'm looking on the system for for information, but I will send out a link to that Belgian. I'll send out the Lexology article, which is a good summary of it, and then I translated the actual decision notice of the Data Protection Authority in Belgium, and I'll send that out as well. Is there anything on the chat, Dave, that we need to have a look at? Just having a quick look through.
I've not been looking at the chat. The other bit that I would suggest from my point, and it's more so I can stop banging on about it, really. Apologies for the language there, but it's something that was kind of a bit of a focus for me last year, was training. And it's not necessarily training people as in this is what the GDPR says or this is what data protection says, but making sure people are appropriately training how to use systems and processes. So how many organizations have you been to? And I'm sure we could all reel off some where you've started there. They've said this is your username and password and off you pop. There's never been any real kind of training on the system use and guidance around, for example, how you might extract something from the system or how you might minimize something within the system. And it's kind of this kind of assumption that people understand how to use things acceptably, but they've never been told.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because again, with this, all the homework, it just makes it exceptionally difficult. We've got a fantastic new starter joining us next week, Matthew, and we've decided not to drag him all the way over to the office for his induction, but we're gonna have to try and do that remotely. And you know, that's going to be a tough ask for him, you know, to keep focused on, the stuff we're throwing at him to look at, you know, and having the confidence to say, look, I don't understand this, or can you go over that again? And for us as a business to try and structure that in such a way that it's easy to consume over this kind of network. But, you know, we've been going at this for nearly a year now, haven't we, with remote working and delivering training. Surely it hasn't been put on pause. It must have been done via Teams. I mean, it's quite effective. I found it quite effective.
I do. The point with training, I'm not suggesting that training is not occurring, but the point with training is very similar to like e-learning with the training, yeah. where the focus is either on data protection, as in these are the principles, this is a SAR, this is how you complete a SAR, this is a breach or might be a breach, this is how you report it, which is fine. So then you say, have you done data protection training? You go, yes, because I've been, somebody's talked to me, or the computer's spoken to me about the principles within the GDPR, for example. But how many people actually tie system training and process training to that? From a security point, if you go back to Article 32 and technical and organizational measures, how many people have appropriate training in system use? So it's not just configuring the system properly, but training people appropriately in how to use it, and having that factored into some kind of training program, as opposed to what appears to be, at least unless it's just the organizations I've previously worked for, which amounts to nothing more than Chinese whispers.
Yeah, it's Tolu's asked a great question, which is what can we do to celebrate Data Protection Day? So just a reminder, this is International Privacy Day, or International Data Protection Day is the 28th of January. Each year. I think we're on the 16th International Privacy Day this year, something like that anyway. And in the past, we've done all sorts of things. I mean, I remember years ago, 2008, I printed up a load of balloons. I was working at Everton Football Club at the time, printed up a load of balloons, and I got in really early and I put balloons all around the offices and all around the, you know, Happy Data Protection Day. And in data protection people, we've done, I'm not suggesting you do all this stuff because it's quite expensive and labour intensive, but we printed up some chocolates, didn't we? Boxes of chocolates, Happy Data Protection Day, and shipped them out to our customers a couple of years ago. But we did a good quiz, didn't we, before Christmas. We knocked off the afternoon and we had a bit of a games afternoon, didn't we, as a remote virtual Christmas session. We did a quiz. So what would you kind of suggest, Dave, Ollie, as things to do? I mean, it's just an opportunity to do something to raise awareness.
Quiz on data protection would be really good, possibly without the alcohol.
You might need the alcohol.
A team session for each business to go through data protection quiz, you know, relating to their area, which would be good. So if you work in customer care, for example, you know, what are the issues in there, and you know, set a load of questions, see if people actually know.
Yeah, you could do case studies. You could do, and yeah, in our training slides, we've got pictures of workplace and, you know, with identifiable security breaches, you know, phones being used in contact centers and screens left on. So you could have a picture. You know, we can provide this kind of stuff if you haven't got it, and so, you know, spot all the security gaffes. You've got some good stuff on that as well, haven't you, Dave?
Or breach or no breach, that sort of thing.
Breach or no breach, yeah, is a good one. So we've got a PowerPoint presentation with a scenario. This happened, you know, is it a breach? Is it not a breach? Is it a reportable breach? That, you know, so these things probably, you know, ideally you want to be putting something out that you know, encouraging people to go and have a look at it and consume it and interact with it, and you know, maybe a few prizes or
I would do all of that. Sounds really good. I'd also involve marketing or at least your internal comms to get on board with pushing some of the information out, and whether you could then start doing themes around things. So when it comes to Easter, what you're going to give up doing? Well, I'm going to give up sending emails to people who I shouldn't be emailing information to. And when you get towards the end of the year, we're going to have a data bonfire day and burn the information or give the essence of data deletion around bonfire and kind of build themes. So people's got a kind of a calendar or program of work and these kind of different themes throughout the year to certainly keep it alive. And you could possibly use data, day on 28th of January to kind of promote or release that this is a work, this is the themes, these are the things we're going to do across the year to keep it front of mind for people.
Yeah, Piers is jumping off, but he's raised a very interesting question, saying that, you know, in the main, the DPOs and the privacy professionals, you know, that I'm skimming this, so if I get this wrong, then it's on the chat. But you know, the IT infosec professionals aren't lawyers, you know, there's distinct, but it is a team collaborative effort, I think is what you're saying. And everybody in an organization, it's like everybody's responsible for sales in an organization, everybody's responsible for information security, whether they're experts or not. So everyone does need to work actively. So thanks for that, Piers. Yeah, so some good stuff we can do on International Data Protection Day. Ollie, have you got any great ideas?
Not necessarily more to add than anything everyone else said, but I mean, realistically, it's such a good opportunity for awareness raising, which is something which we're always talking about, and any opportunity, I mean, you just have to take it, really.
Yeah, poster campaigns. You can get free posts from the ICO. We sometimes produce like A4, A3 posters. We've got some other posters. So, you know, I guess it depends on the environment. Posters probably are no good because nobody's in the offices, but, you know, they could be pushed out as wallpaper, as email attachments, or put on the portals or whatever. But it's just an opportunity to bang on about, you know, today is a day to consider data protection and privacy, you know, maybe kind of challenge people to have their own resolutions. You know, what are the top three things you're going to do this year, or out of these 10 things, you know, which ones would you rank the most important? I don't know, but there's a whole lot of stuff. And if you want us to come up with some ideas and suggestions, we'll have a yak about it one afternoon and put some stuff together if that might be useful for people.
Yeah, we've got a couple of questions. I don't know if we've missed them or not seen them, but there's one from Maria Cooper. There's also a lot of noise about the change to the WhatsApp PN, saying that they will be sharing user data with Facebook. Need to be even more vigilant about what do you think using WhatsApp?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I'd read that. I'd seen that WhatsApp were changing the privacy policy, and they were kind of saying if you don't agree to it, then you can't use it. In that sense, so it's an odd kind of an agreement. It's kind of telling you it's going to happen. You've got no option in it. WhatsApp, well, Facebook on WhatsApp anyway, so he's sharing it with his parent company. And when I read that, I wasn't actually surprised. I thought they were doing it anyway, to be fair.
No, I thought they did as well, to be honest.
People's got to, I can't say it's the right thing and I can't necessarily say it's the wrong thing. I think it's one of those that you read the privacy information yourself and decide whether you want organisations like that crawling all over your private life and making decisions on that. It has privacy implications of it, but it's at the end of the day, individuals are individuals. They're adults, are entitled to read privacy policies and make the decisions for themselves. Although it can be considered quite privacy intrusive, and they shouldn't be offering something that appears to be a consent based when it's not consent, if it's going to happen whether you like it or not anyway.
Is it positioned as consent based?
It's only something I've loosely read. I need to go back and read it more. I have seen a couple of articles on WhatsApp and going to Facebook, but I didn't dive into it too much because I thought Facebook were doing it anyway.
Okay, so we'll see what comes up in the chat. So I think have we got anything else we need to kind of add on to the New Year's resolutions, do you think? You know, anything that we... So I made a bit of a list here, getting a comprehensive audit, program in place, compliance checking, much more of that, maybe distributing that out, getting more people involved in compliance checking. Maybe I've got my roast-tinted specs on again. Critical audit of ROPAs, again, these are a central document. Every time we look at ROPAs, we find holes in them, don't we? We find that we can go on site virtually or physically and find posting activities not on the ROPAs. So if we can do it, why can't everybody else do it? Gaps in the ROPAs, fields with, the wrong stuff in them, mostly because it's Excel-based, isn't it? Most of the ROPAs we look at. And because you can write anything in a cell, then people do write anything in a cell. They add columns on, don't they? I mean, interesting. So I would say those. You mentioned this, Dave, getting off spreadsheets, get onto a proper compliance management platform with proper record keeping, proper audit trails, proper security.
Proper structure. Coming back to free text and bits and pieces like that, it's getting a proper structure and a compliant structure in the way that you can use that's accessible to everybody and securely saved. So you've not lost that intelligence.
Yeah, a massive push. Maybe this is something to do for International Privacy Day, is a massive housekeeping effort on old records, trying to push that message. You review what you've got, particularly emails, and delete them. IT security, technical measures particularly, but org as well. And then looking at compliance risks and training. They're kind of things we've talked about, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, it's all quite interesting, isn't it? Because it all kind of interlinks. So it's a bit like, where do you start? Because if I do this, well, if I do ROPAs first, do I need mapping in order to complete the ROPA in that sense? Or do I need to understand what we're doing from a policy point and then bits and pieces? So it's training and security around it. So I think some of it may come from looking at where you are. Arguably, because of the accountability and the requirement for accountability, whatever you're doing, you're going to have to be able to show evidentially that you've thought about it or you've documented it somewhere, you've got something to back up and demonstrate how you meet the requirements. So I think a big one in whatever you're going to do this year, make sure that you can that you are able to meet accountability. So for example, if you say you're compliant, can you demonstrate that you are compliant? When was the last time you did a compliance check? When was the last time you opened yourself up to an external audit? And bits and pieces around those areas. Can you actually demonstrate what you've got is robust? And if you believe what you've got is robust, and you believe you've got a level of compliance that you feel is acceptable, then open it up to scrutiny and have an audit check on that, just to make sure you've not missed anything.
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a lot of things we haven't talked about. We've not talked about processes and data sharing, but again, they're probably in the mix as well, aren't they?
Well, I've avoided talking about processes and things, because otherwise we might not have another session coming up next week when we start looking at the implications of Brexit and bits and pieces. So I'm trying to avoid over talking next week.
So next week we're talking about particularly focused on the how the Brexit situation currently is, how it's going to be for the next 5.5 months, because we're in this transitional period. And then how we think it might work after that. I don't know if you noticed lots of queues at the ports reporting on the BBC. So there's a lot of additional paperwork to do. I don't, I don't, you know, that's a physical transportation, isn't it? So we'll have a look at that next week. So that'll be quite interesting, won't it? Because things have settled a little bit, but the European Essential Guarantees and the new standard contractual clauses, I think they should be adopted in February. So we can cover those. They're not going to go away, are they?
Well, regardless of whatever is happening with free flow of information from the UK to the EU, we will be a third country. And if we get adequacy, then you can kind of go, we can stand down a bit. It's fine. You still have the implications of being a third country and having that all identified. But if you're sending anything outside of the EU, you're still going to have to rely on some kind of transfer mechanism. And that may well be standard contractual clauses. The ICO may accept the standard contractual clauses that's published by the EU, because why wouldn't they? In that sense, so you may well end up thinking, well, do we rely on them standard contractual clauses for transfers to the US, Israel, India, wherever else you might have people accessing your data?
And do you think we'll get an adequacy agreement?
I think it's more likely. In my little naive world, I guess I'll be thinking, well, if we weren't going to get adequacy, I'm not saying it's guaranteed, but if we weren't going to get adequacy, why would they give us it for 6 months? Just to then say no. So I think it's probably more likely. I'm not certainly saying it's not guaranteed. I think it's more likely, but I think it's still going to be a political pawn over the next few months.
Yeah, my hunch, I would bet money on the fact that we will get one. But I suspect it'll get used as a political lever in the future. You know, if you don't do this, then we'll remove your adequacy. So it just, maybe I'm being cynical, but granted adequacy gives the Europeans more leverage going forward.
It would seem odd not to get adequacy on the grounds of the fact that we've got the GDPR, we've been integrated with Europe for 47 years or whatever it was, and that kind of thing from a legal point and under the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice. But if you're based in America, you can just loosely agree to privacy shield, as it were, and add adequacy that way. So I would have thought, if we've got in place, whether it's watertight, whether it's watertight, must at least be a higher standard than what it was in America, and information transferred to America quite easily under Privacy Shield, which appeared to be nothing more than, yes, I think we comply with it.
Yeah. Now, the week after that, the 22nd of Jan, we're going to talk about, it says here, 7 ways to simplify SARS. So I think, we'll probably wheel Kathy out because she's running our...
What do you mean, wheel Kathy out?
Well, showcase Kathy and the SAR Bureau. So we're going to be talking about subject action requests and how to simplify the processes involved in receiving them, evaluating them, dealing with them. So that'll be quite interesting as well, I think. And then we've got International Data Privacy Day, and we're doing 6 hours, aren't we, of podcasting. Miles has put us up for doing an all-day podcast. I was quite keen to try and have a Guinness record attempt, but I think it's like 4 days, isn't it, the longest ever podcast.
Sure we could go on for 4 days, Phil.
Well, I know we could go on for 4 days, but we're not doing that this year. We're just going to do 6 hours. We've got small businesses in there, and we've got some features with small businesses, and possibly the Federation of Small Businesses talking. So there's an hour on that. I think there's an hour on other sectors as well, sector specific. So I think we'll probably put the program together this week and then send it out next week. And then we've got a specific day on the education sector, 29th of Jan. That's just a 1 hour on for our education clients, and then it goes out. So if you want to see what we're talking about in the future, Safer Internet Day, accountability, compliance auditing, that'd be great, because Dilik will have done a lot of her training, and we'll get Dilik on that one. Quite a lot of interesting things coming up we want to talk about. Any final comments? I think we've got 5 minutes left, Dave, but I think we've probably exhausted the resolutions topic. Anything coming up this week you want to talk about?
There's a couple of things. I'd seen something just to kind of finish off again, going back to the news, I'll have to dig it out, but there was a German case, I don't know if you picked up on it, just in relation to subject access requests, which basically said that information yet to be obtained is not subject to a SAR. And that kind of amused me somewhat, because I wouldn't have thought that would have been a case that made it to court. I would have thought it was obvious that if you didn't have the information, it wouldn't be subject to a subject access request, but it was a German case, yeah. I'll have to try and drag it out, but it related to somebody putting a subject access request for processing going to a supplier and wanted details of the supplier, and only had the name and they didn't have the contact details. And they went, well, we don't have the contact details. And then it all went to court, and the court went, well, you can't have it if they don't have it. in that kind of sense. But it would seem rather obvious as opposed to having to spend a load of money in court. But I'm sure it was a German case, but I can try and dig it out if anybody's interested. But it does seem to be kind of just reiterating the obvious, but in court.
Yeah. Ollie, what have you got coming up this week? You got a busy week? You got a lot of work with your clients, haven't you?
Yeah, plenty as ever. Particularly looking at something that is quite interesting. We're going to be kickstarting next week, hopefully, or at least in the next couple of weeks, a big DPIA on one of my clients' products, which is subject to the Age Appropriate Design Code of Practice.
Oh, right. Okay, fab.
So that's going to be a really good, interesting piece of work. So I'm looking forward to getting stuck into that. But then, yeah, otherwise, just the usual.
Just the usual. I'm doing quite a lot of work on the information governance framework. I spent a few hours today just going through, reviewing it, updating bits of the changes in the legislation, the way it's described, and just kind of tweaking it, adding in the new guidance notes, and just adding some additional documents we've developed into it. So I've got a lot more work to do next week on that. And also, we're finishing off some of the developments on DataWise next week, and then we're going to start off a revision of the ROPAs and the information asset registers. And funny to talk about data mapping, because I want to kind of visualize data mapping within the DataWise platform so that you can see on a map where data is and how it's flowing about. That's one of the that'll take us a few months to crack that technically, but you know, that's one of the enhancements I want to try and get my head around in the spring.
That's
anyway.
Quite an interesting point, actually, Phil, because without trying to go on, I was actually going to raise that with when you're talking about data mapping. Are you talking about a visual map, or are you talking about data mapping as being in a table form, or whether it's just simply what suits the audience? Some people prefer to see things visually. Some people can understand it quite easily in a table.
I tell you, I did work with, when we were doing work with I can't really name, I don't think, a major pharmaceutical FMCG company that make baby milk. Global company, and we're working with them, and they commissioned data mapping, and they built a tool to visualize all the data. You could just drill into it, and you click on a data flow to tell you, you know, what data, where it originated from, how it's protected, where it was flowing to. It was a really superb bit of work. They used I can't remember what it was now, an open software platform, built their own framework to record all this stuff. But when it was finished, it was a really good bit of work. So I've got it in my mind, you know, I like, you need a tabular format, but some of this stuff has got complex relationships, you know, many to many type relationships. It's hard to put a table together. So being able to visualize it and look at a piece of data, then see where it goes, or look at a flow and see what's contained within that flow. That's how I envisage, you know, I think two ways. I think tabular, and I also think visually as well. So if you can try and achieve something that does that, that's my goal anyway.
Oh, absolutely. And
there's something land in my back garden.
And it's just trying to get the visual look to it. It looks, so it doesn't look like a plate of spaghetti, isn't it? Because sometimes they, like you said, they can be so complex.
It's got to be, it's layered, to hasn't the neatest, it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's got to be the neatest kind of run a line so you can actually see where information's going, otherwise they do get awfully complicated.
Yeah. Actually,
can do that, it would save me the headache of having to work my way through it.
Yeah, I was adding some fields into Salesforce yesterday for Miles, and I noticed that they've got some new metadata on fields, which is whether the field you're creating is required for compliance, and it's got a list of compliance, including GDPR. So it's got HIP, it's got GDPR, it's got some American standards as well. But that's really good, because that means that you can look on your data. Whatever it's called, the data map, not the data map, the schema, the database schema, and find out which fields are critical for compliance and which fields aren't. So again, that's a really good, I think we've been talking about this for years, actually, you know, why aren't the database providers, you know, helping us to see what data is important by providing this type of metadata on fields. Interestingly enough, Salesforce have done that.
For sure, yeah, no, it's certainly, because especially for organisations that's caught by, like you say, HIPAA, CPPA, or CCPA, GDPR, anything else in between, it would certainly be useful for those international kind of systems used in many different jurisdictions to have that. That certainly sounds like a worthy tool.
Yeah, and the other thing, just kind of the other thing, we're not promoting Salesforce. We don't, we like them, but we don't get anything for promoting them. But I was on the phone to them the other week, because they rang up and said, we've got this new service called, they call it Shield, yeah, and basically you can, I did talk about this before, didn't I, you can encrypt your data, so Salesforce currently has encrypted fields, but you're limited to how many encrypted fields you can have on each database object. But they've got this new service where you can encrypt your entire data. And I rang them up and I said, this is really interesting because of the international transfers piece. So if the data, our data is in London and the other data, you know, backed up to Frankfurt, but if there's a chance of the data going over to the States or to anywhere else, then you could subscribe to this service. It's one-way encryption. So Salesforce haven't got any ability to decrypt the data. It's all kind of client-led encryption keys. So that, to me, would be a really good supplementary measure for an international transfer if your data in Salesforce was going over to the States. So I rang him up and said, sure. this is a great marketing opportunity for you. Can I have a cut of the profits? I haven't heard back them, funny enough.
And are you joining us from your yacht in the Med today, Phil? Or you just that off?
No, I didn't hear back from them.
I just wanted to say there's been an announcement that London's now under major incident because of COVID. So any of our southern clients that are on here or people that are here, to be really careful and take care of yourselves, because it's getting quite serious everywhere now. Mm-hmm. And we appreciate your support joining us for lunchtime, and hopefully you'll be on the next session. So if you can all stay safe and well, that'd be great.
I think we've been closed down there, Dave. What nice close there, Kathy. So yes, you can finish off, Kathy. Yeah, thanks very much, everyone, for joining us. Thanks for your contributions. Thanks, Dave and Ollie, for taking part and for driving the session. Thanks, Kathy. Thanks, Miles. Nice to see you, Matthew. We'll see you on Monday at the induction and the kit. And if there's nothing else, then we'll dive off. We'll follow up the questions people have asked, and we'll hopefully see you next week to talk about Brexit again.
Yeah, thanks everybody. That was great.
Thanks all.